So maybe you know this experience. It often happens with the people we're closest to, the people we love most. But it's like over time becomes so deeply familiar with them, with their personality and habits, with their love and their suffering, so familiar with their face that we somehow stop seeing them. And instead, what we see is a kind of frozen conception of who they are. And that it's where we can look at them, but we're not really seeing. We're seeing through layers and layers of concept. I noticed this kind of most clearly with my parents, you know. It's like just so hard to cut through all of the conditioning of our karmic history together and the role that they have played in my life. And the role that all of my kind of projection and hope and fear, and it's just like I sometimes have the intention to see, but I can't quite cut through the density of the concepts. And of course, when we relate to another as a concept, we lose all of the kind of spontaneity and aliveness. We're living with them as a vision from the past, and the kind of intimacy that can happen when we cut through that is lost. But then maybe after some years or decades, we might deeply look at them. And ask the question, like, who are you? Now, this happens with others, with loved ones, but it happens with another person too. Yeah. So, selflessness, self-love, confidence. We can never take refuge in a sense of self. We try to make that our home, to kind of find a place to rest, a shelter. But notions of self can never provide a refuge. There's always some measure of alienation in that gesture. Maybe you know the experience of like doing mental noting. We haven't emphasized it on this retreat, but it's a kind of quite foundational in this lineage. And you know, you're noting experience moment by moment, and there are different rubrics, different ways of noting, and different ways of cutting up the pie of experience. But it might be, you know, sometimes you're noting feeling, you know, emotional feeling states, or you're noting some sense of intention or buzzing or throbbing, or, you know, tasting, all the chewing, these kinds of simple labels. Yeah. And maybe, you know, the experience of like getting the note, and it's like, it's the right note, and it like helps the attention like sink right in. It's like, yeah, that is hatred. Or whatever it is, yeah? But then maybe you know the experience of like not getting the note quite right, yeah? And self is like that. It's like a note we don't get quite right. The default assumption is one of kind of self-constancy, the opposite of anicca. And this interesting study was published in the journal Science a few years ago, and it looked at about 19,000 people, and it asked people at all different ages. They'd ask a 50-year-old, how much do you think you're going to change in the next decade in terms of personality and values and taste, style, that kind of thing? How much do you think you're going to change in the next decade? And then they ask 60-year-olds, how much did you change during your 50s? Yeah. And then they look to see whether the people predicted as much change, the 50-year-old predicted as much change as the 60-year-old reported having, yeah? And what they found was people always, like, sort of under-predicted the change that they would likely experience. Does that make sense? Yeah? So the authors conclude, people, it seems, regard the present as a watershed moment at which they have finally become the person they will be for the rest of their lives. History, it seems, is always ending today. Yeah, it's funny, but not. So with this anatta business, it's so easy to get philosophical and try to like think our way into the insight, you know. Try to kind of manufacture it, and a lot of what's being emphasized is not, we actually set conditions, we cultivate capacities, we nourish the continuity of attention, we nourish sincerity and the willingness to be surprised by our hearts and minds. We nourish and cultivate all of this, and then maybe there's some insight. But so often it gets picked up as a kind of philosophical thing, and it's not meant to be that. So this is Tanisaro Bhikkhu. Even in his most thoroughgoing teachings about not-self, the Buddha never recommends replacing the assumption that there is a self with the assumption that there is no self. Instead, he only goes so far as to point out the drawbacks of various ways of conceiving the self, and then to recommend dropping them. A lot of our thoughts, our kind of philosophical musings about self or selflessness, are basically a vision of the self getting better. You know? It's like the insight is, without knowing it, we're really envisioning insight as a kind of decoration of the self, like a accoutrement. I don't think I know what that word means, but so it's like, it's just envisioned like it's another acquisition of the self, which tolerates nothing good outside itself, you know? But the philosophical questions and all of that, it's apparent, like, seeming conflicts. I think they're not real conflicts. What I would say is that the self is an experience, not self is an experience, and two experiences do not contradict each other. Yeah. So we're learning to actually appreciate all of this. Generally, it sounds like there's an opposition between confidence or self-love and the emptiness of self. But really, I think of it as more like there's a continuum of self, and self-hatred is on this end, and emptiness of self is on this end, and confidence, self-love, is like on this half of the spectrum, yeah? And in a way, it's like, when we think about like confidence or self-love or self-kindness or something, we're actually getting less and less rigid in how we conceive ourselves. Like self confidence or self-love is not like, I'm great. I'm like fucking great. You know, like, that's brittle. Yeah? Confidence, self-love is more like, I'm good, I'm bad, you know. Like less and less of a preoccupation, less and less sticky. The whole domain, you know, is just less, and it's like the self-hatred is just this kind of like preoccupation. The self is more coagulated in that state than self-kindness, self-love, confidence, yeah? And so the self that is loved is much easier to forget than the self that's hated, yeah? This is Jack Engler, psychologist and Buddhist meditation person, teacher, says, as a psychologist, part of my effort is to help people develop capacities that may have been underdeveloped or derailed earlier in development or may have been compromised by subsequent trauma. So ego, in this sense, is a positive thing. That's the way I think of it in psychology. But a lot of people who come to me for therapy don't think of ego that way. They think of ego in a spiritual context where it's a bad thing. But talking about ego in a spiritual context, to me, is even more problematic. It gets talked about almost like it's an alternate personality within me that's bad. It gets reified as some part of me that I have to battle with, that I have to transcend. I think spiritual language reinforces a lot of dualistic thinking when we talk about ego that way, unless we're really careful how we define it. Now, instead of self versus other, it's self versus ego. And so the struggle continues in another guise. So there's this real appreciation that that loving the self is fully compatible with this kind of insight into not self, and that we're learning to actually affirm self and to say yes to the sensory components of that experience, the sensory components of the sense of I am-ness, the feelings and thoughts and all of that. We can just actually say yes to them. And when we say yes in one way, there is confidence, self-love, kindness. And when we say yes even more deeply, maybe we understand the insight into not self. So the Buddha emphasized even the well-adjusted self carries a burden of dukkha. Even the well-adjusted self carries a burden. Sarab Burbia. Clinging always and inevitably involves measurement and comparison. As the Buddhist philosopher Dharmakirti asserted, clinging is the intrinsic reflex of the self-sense. Even when it's not present as a thought, at least a very subtle perspective of self-investment accompanies any sense of self. How will this thing be for me? How will its changing or its continuing? What will its changing or its continuing mean for me? What can I get? As we've seen, looking through a lens of belief in a self, things are made to stand out to perception. They're given substance. So that last piece we'll come back to. There are a few senses of the way we use this self, clinging to let go of self-view, of clinging to self. And one sense is really about the kind of images we have about ourselves, the ideas that we hold about who we are, about what makes us valuable, or what is a cause for shame. The kind of long list of yeses and nos about me. And we spend so much time and effort curating this self, you know, performing this for ourselves and for others. When we start to actually really look at what happens in the mind, the papancha, the mental proliferation, so much of it is about this kind of effort to curate the self, this way of ensuring that our sense of who we are is confirmed, of engineering situations so that the kind of challenging, the views that might challenge ego are avoided, you know? And so we stand guard like at the gates of self, anxious about who's an intruder and who's a welcome guest. You know, it's like, if I'm like very deeply invested in thinking of myself as a good teacher, any one of you can ruin my life. You know? right? The person who just hates this Dharma talk, right? Or yeah. Zane, a 3-month retreat, and I don't know, this may be like a month or two in of just, you know, practice. I was practicing from, yeah, like 5 a.m. till 11 at night, and, you know, just going for it. And then I got a note on the board, and it said, Matthew, the New York Times would like to interview you. Please call this reporter at this number. You know, and like, okay. The New York Times, the paper of record. I grew up in New York. It's like, and I was like, okay, what about my life is like, there are only two things that are like remotely public that they could possibly be interested in. At that time I was doing addiction research. I was doing research on methamphetamine dependence and clinical trials for medications to treat meth dependence. And I was teaching meditation. But I was neither a famous meditation teacher nor a high-impact scientist. You know, I had published stuff, but not in major, you know, high top-tier scientific journals. It's like, why would they want to talk to me about either of these things? And then I thought, you know, maybe I am a big deal. Oh, okay. At this point in the story, if you're rooting for me, stop. So we play, you know, I'm like, okay, I gotta call this person. Okay, so I play a little phone tag. I get a hold of him, and the one public piece of my life that I had forgotten was that a couple years before, some friends of mine were, I officiated their wedding, and to be like an official minister, I went online and took 5 minutes to become an online minister in basically a fake church, you know, because I thought that was necessary for the, you know, kind of whatever, the courthouse or, you know, the marriage papers or something. I had to be a minister. So I went online. I did it. I was a minister. The New York Times was doing a story on fake ministers and their sham weddings that were legally questionable and wanted to talk to me. Because the wedding that I had performed was written up in the New York Times as Matthew Brentsover with his fake whatever, fake minister. Oh, God. Oh, it was like I got off the phone and I just like doubled over laughing, you know, because it was just like live by the ego, die by the ego, you know, right? Yeah, it just can't work out, and it's just so much effort to curate. So we practice draining the kind of emotional charge from the self story as it arises. You know, it's like a million times we're sitting there and something arises, and either it's very explicit or it's more subtle. There's some investment of I am this. You know, maybe it's just I'm a good meditator, or I'm a dedicated practitioner, or I'm a whatever, you know. But whatever it is, if it's invested, you know, if there's that egoic investment, it makes us more fragile. It makes us more brittle in life. And so it arises, and then essentially we are learning to drain some of the emotional charge from that egoic investment. And so the challenges to the ego arise, and we develop equanimity. The failures and the inevitable humiliations of trying to be someone are like known and discharged just there in the body with equanimity. And over time, the kind of insistence on that list of I am and I am not, that starts to soften. It starts to feel no more charge to think of oneself as good, as not good. Yeah. And there's a lot of freedom in that. A lot of freedom for ourselves, and then a lot of freedom in the way that the egoic pressure does not leak out onto others. Because the ego's kind of project is to have you capitulate with my sense of who I am. Yeah. And that's a kind of undue burden that I would put on you. Yeah. To mirror my sense of self, to kind of support my egoic notion, you know. And so we drain the charge from that, and then you know, that when there's less and less leaking from us out, then the other person really actually gets to be in a freer way. There are other ways self operates, other kind of maybe more subtle forms of self. And a lot of this is very involved with, is forged with, in the realm of thought, in, you know, discursive thinking. So this is old student of Joseph Goldstein and Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, Sam Harris. Let consciousness be a single sphere of experience. Where are you in this condition? Where is the self that answers to the name of I? Is there actually a center to this experience, or is there just experience? Most of us spend most of our lives feeling like we are the thinker of our thoughts. Where is this thinker? Isn't there only the next thought that arises? If you look closely, you'll begin to see that the feeling of being a thinker, the feeling that you are authoring your thoughts or that you are identical to them, that is what it's like to be thinking without noticing that you're thinking. Just notice the next thought. Think of the Eiffel Tower. Now think of a red bus. Now remember the name of the first president of the United States. How could any of these appearances be what you are? You're simply noticing them. How is it that you can ever feel identical to this voice that seems to be in your head? How is this engine of anxiety and self-criticism keeps turning every hour and day? So it's an investigation of, like, not turning towards the breathing, but turning towards the actual sense of I-amness. Like, what actually creates the sense of ground of our being? You know, in some contexts, that's described in positive light, the ground of being. And we can come back to that, but in this context, it's like, no, what's the ground of self? What creates the sense of the perspective from which we gaze out? The sense of, like, the kind of center point receiving experience, the self that is behind the body, behind the mind, the reference point for all experience, that sense of self is made up of experience, not something. Experience does not emanate from somewhere. Experience arises out of causes and conditions, including the sense of self that kind of pulls us out of the world, that makes us feel like we are separate from nature, that puts you there and me here. And so part of our practice is actually learning to fold this into mindful awareness. The philosopher Dan Dennett described the self as the center of narrative gravity. First, he went on to talk about, like, the center of gravity of an object, which is not a thing, really. It's not a place, exactly. But that notion is coherent, the center of gravity. And he said the self is the center of narrative gravity. Yeah. It's like, it feels like it all converges there. And that feels like the kind of innermost part of our being. It's very closely linked with the discursive kind of thought. It's like when we think we go home to self, we're whispering to ourselves. Yeah? We're talking in our own minds. The sit ends, the bell rings, and then it's like, the attention had been out, and then it kind of returns to the sense of home base. Me. Oh, I should da, 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 da. And that voice is so cozy and so familiar and not noticed as another arising that it feels like it's the ground of being. So, scholar Andy Olinsky says, grasping is not something done by the self, rather the self is something done by grasping. I'll say more about that in a minute. So, who are you when there's no clinging. As clinging fades and gets more and more quiet, who are you? Now, maybe we say, we imagine the same person that I am, but that's not so. Clinging, it makes experience kind of dense. We can think about a kind of spectrum of experience from like very dense to empty, you know? And the density is often very strongly correlated with the amount of suffering. And so at the dense end, like when we're in some storm in our own minds, it's like experience is so real and substantial. It has a kind of weight and density. And then we start to like let go more and more and start to get lighter, more transparent, more like space. So what happens when nothing is setting off even the subtlest alarm bells in your own system? Nothing, there is no sense of threat. Not even a pain in the knee or whatever, like nothing is setting off even the slightest alarm. Yeah. And we start to let go. Everything becomes lighter. And there's no need for a view. There's no need for perception. There's no need for a plan or strategy or defense. Maybe you notice in meditation when the more kind of like safe you feel, the more you can forget the self. The less and less you feel like under siege by pain or the future or some kind of threat, the more you can just forget who you thought you were. And then some stimulus like frightens you, right? We hear a noise that startles us or something. And the emptiness of that noise is not perceived. It feels dense, it lands. And then we're put back into the corner of the sense of I am-ness from the vagueness, the spaciousness. And so in some ways, maybe we orchestrate our survival, our self-preservation, by hallucinating a sense of self. And this is very closely linked to bhava-tanha, the craving for becoming. Craving for persistence, for the next moment to include me. And, you know, the wish to stay alive, to be alive, is so innocent and so totally reasonable, but it's unquestioned. Like, we don't even ask the question, is life better than non-existence? And I don't mean to say that life is not better, but to have that answer has a whole cascade of effects, you know? Yeah, like it's like the mortality fear, it just feels like the kind of the bedrock of every other concern, you know? And so we usually think about the self as a kind of cause. Our intentions, we have a cause, the self causes things, it changes things, it gets things, it makes things. But in an important sense, self is an effect. It's an effect of fear. And it is, I believe, what makes death so terrifying. The sense of the vanquishing of the self. So, philosopher Derek Parfit, who not a meditator that I know of, but would do these like wild thought experiments and a lot of deep reflection around self and identity and in his explorations kind of like he shared some beautiful things, and he described the loss of the sense of self, this what he calls the deep further fact, and the kind of freedom that came out of that. So he said, it's difficult to believe that there's no such thing as an all or nothing self, no deep further fact beyond the multitude of small psychological facts that make you who you are. When I believe that my existence was such a further fact, I seemed imprisoned in myself. My life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. I now live in the open air. There is still a difference between my life and the lives of other people, but the difference is less. Other people are closer. I'm less concerned about the rest of my own life and more concerned about the lives of others. In this tradition, a Nietzsche is often the doorway into this. In other traditions, it's different. In other traditions, it's more like it's said like you look for the self, and the not finding is the finding. You know, it's the one Tibetan frame. But in insight practice, generally, anicca, impermanence, is the kind of gateway to an insight into anatta. And anicca, like, sometimes we stand on the, you know, we sort of like stand on the bank looking at the river of change, but At some point, we realize the bank is the river too. Yeah. And Anicca has a kind of undertow. Like as the mindfulness develops, like the flow of change, it like wants to pull all of you in. Yeah. And we start to like feel the undertow of Anicca and start surrendering more and more of the ground of I am-ness into that flow. And as we do this, the awareness that without knowing it, the awareness always tasted like me. Yeah. Like the awareness has a kind of flavor. And we let go more and more deeply. And the awareness becomes tasteless. Like a kind of diesel engine that's been running our whole life and we just acclimatize to it and the engine cuts off. And this is a cause for courage, you know. Like amidst that emptiness, the world has no hooks to catch us. And so we become, the world feels more and more safe, and we can offer safety to other beings. And so there is this strong connection between between not self and love. It's like the more the attention was pooled up in supporting the self system, the more it's just like preoccupied. All that energy, like when it's freed up, goes outwards. And this doesn't make us like hate the self that when that re-arises. It's like the poignancy, the drama of self-identification and its attendant pain becomes just more and more poignant. So the dramas and sorrows and swirls that we get in, it becomes a cause for more care and compassion. And since this is really cutting through clinging, you know, it's cutting through the forces of greed and aversion, we can ask, like, what's left? What's left when there's not clinging? And like the heart is at like a very deep rest, idling, but in the face of suffering, in the face of joy, in the face of success, it just rises up. And the love born out of that silence feels like the most authentic thing we've ever done in our lives. Very natural. Like water running down a hill. There's a certain kind of completeness of our life in that. And so there's not really anything left to do other than to to live and serve and die.